Welcome, everybody, to History Analyzed. I'm your host, Mark Palmer. This is a podcast which examines historical events and issues. The event we're analyzing today is Gavrilo Princip igniting the First World War. There have been many political assassins throughout history. Marcus Junius Brutus might be history's most famous assassin when he and his buddies murdered Julius Caesar on March 15, 44 BCE. Some assassins have been completely forgotten. Very few people remember that Charles Guiteau killed President James Garfield in 1881, or that Leon Czolgosz assassinated President William McKinley in 1901. Some political assassins affected great change, and some not so much. John Wilkes Booth robbed us of our greatest president. We will never know how Abraham Lincoln would have handled Reconstruction after the Civil War, but we can be certain that he would have done a much better job than his successor, Andrew Johnson. But of all of the political assassins throughout history, I would argue that the one who had the greatest effect on the world was Gavrilo Princip. His assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand, the heir to the throne of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, ignited the powder keg, which was Europe, in 1914. I know that there are some historians that argue Princip's act did not inevitably lead to World War I. That is true. One of the things that makes history so interesting is that nothing is inevitable. However, one act can set off an entire chain of events. Certainly, after Princip assassinated the Archduke, a lot of world leaders had to make many stupid decisions to plunge the world into the greatest war ever seen up to that date. But it was two shots from the gun of Gavrilo Princip which set everything into motion. Princip shooting the Archduke was the proximate cause of World War I. The war started exactly 1 month after he shot Archduke Ferdinand in Sarajevo on June 28, 1914. That war would drag on for 4.5 years and kill approximately 20 million people. We only have estimates, but it is believed that approximately 10 million military personnel were killed in World War I, along with about 10 million civilians. Historians disagree about the precise number of deaths from the Great War. I've seen estimates of military deaths anywhere between 8.5 to 15 million, and I've seen civilian death estimates somewhere between 6 and 13 million. But the total of military and civilian deaths is somewhere in that ballpark of 20 million. And any number close to a total of 20 million people killed is just an insane amount of carnage. First, let me deal with a few names. I believe that I'm pronouncing the assassin's name correctly as Gavrilo Princip. Although I've heard it pronounced slightly differently at times, I think that's the correct pronunciation. If not, please forgive me. Another name we have to deal with is the name of the war. Obviously, at the time, nobody called it World War I because nobody knew that there was going to be a World War II. Back then, it was usually referred to as the Great War. The term great referencing the extent and intensity of the death and destruction between 1914 and 1918. It was a war that unleashed newfound horrors of gas attacks, aerial bombing, and all of the other atrocities which were created as a gruesome byproduct of the Industrial Revolution. I'm not saying that Gavrilo Princip is responsible for all of the misery and killing. There's a decent chance that, in some form, a conflict like World War I would have occurred in the early part of the 20th century. But Princip is the one that lit the fuse that set so much of the world ablaze. And let's go further. There are some, and I'm one of them, that argue that the First World War led to the Second World War. The failures of the Treaty of Versailles, which ended World War I, at least between Germany and the Western Allies, created a climate which led to the acceptance of political parties on the lunatic fringe like the Nazis. Clearly, there were countless other factors which led to the rise of the Nazis, foremost being the Great Depression after the Wall Street crash of October 1929. But the resentment of the German people after World War I led them to follow a murderous, psychotic tyrant like Adolf Hitler. By the end of World War I, the commander-in-chief of all Allied armies on the Western Front was French Marshal Ferdinand Foch. He was very unhappy with the terms of the Versailles Treaty and famously said, "This is not a peace, it is an armistice for 20 years." He proved to be incredibly accurate in the summer of 1919, because 20 years and 2 months later, World War II broke out on September 1, 1939, when Nazi Germany invaded Poland. Before we get into Gavrilo Princip assassinating Archduke Franz Ferdinand, first we have to look into the situation of Europe in June 1914. This was the sunset of the age of European empires. Europe was dominating the world. Countries that are powerful today were not world powers at the time. China was in total chaos and would not become a global force until after World War II. The United States had all of the resources and abilities which, 31 years later, would make it the most powerful country in the history of the world. But in the summer of 1914, the U.S. did not have much interest on the world stage. America was fairly content staying out of international affairs. The Europeans were the other extreme. Except for Russia, these were geographically small countries that were dominating the earth. In June 1914, European countries controlled all of Africa as colonies, except for Liberia and Ethiopia. It was insane. You had tiny countries like Portugal and Belgium with huge African colonies. Europeans considered most of the world their economic playground. And it wasn't just Africa that Europeans were exploiting. They had many colonies in Asia. Most notably, Britain controlled the enormous populations of the large area which now constitutes India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and Sri Lanka. The French controlled Indochina, which now comprises Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia. Even the tiny Netherlands ruled a huge region which, at that time, was called the Dutch East Indies and is now called the country of Indonesia, with a current population of over 270 million people. The point of all this is that a war on the European continent truly affected the entire world. So what was the status of Europe in June 1914? There were five great powers in Europe at that time: Britain, France, Germany, Russia, and Austria-Hungary. You are certainly familiar with the first four, but maybe not with that last one. It's time to go into the Austro-Hungarian Empire. You will hear that country called either Austria-Hungary or the Austro-Hungarian Empire. It's a long and complicated history, which I cannot get into all the details in this episode, but here are the key points. Emperor Franz Joseph was considered the Emperor of Austria and the King of Hungary, but it was all considered one big country, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, or Austria-Hungary. The empire consisted of many ethnic groups. The two nationalities in control were the Hungarians and the Austrians. And to complicate matters, the Austrians were ethnic Germans, but that's too convoluted of an issue to get into here. Besides the Austrians and Hungarians, there were many ethnic minorities in Austria-Hungary. There were Czechs, Poles, Ukrainians, Slovaks, Slovenes, Croatians, Serbs, Italians, Romanians, Bosniaks, and a few other minorities. These ethnic groups spoke their own languages. And there were several religions in the empire, including Catholics, Protestants, Eastern Orthodox, Jews, and Muslims. Most of the ethnic minorities, meaning everybody other than the Austrians and the Hungarians, did not want to be part of Austria-Hungary. These minorities were not represented in the government, and most wanted their own countries. I'll come back to Austria-Hungary in a little bit. First, I will tell you about the other four European powers. France was the only true republic of the European powers. The United Kingdom was, and still is, a constitutional monarchy. Russia was an autocratic state ruled by Tsar Nicholas II, and Germany was an empire ruled by Kaiser Wilhelm II. Fun fact, Both of those terms for the autocratic rulers of Russia and Germany are based upon the name Caesar. After the death of Julius Caesar, the name Caesar essentially became synonymous with the term emperor. That's how the Germans got the word Kaiser for their emperor, and the Russians got Tsar for their emperor, which is why the more sensible spelling of that word is C-Z-A-R. By 1914, there were two grand alliances. On one side was the Triple Entente, which joined Britain, France, and Russia. On the other side, there was the dual alliance of the Central Powers, Germany and Austria-Hungary. During World War I, the Central Powers would also be joined by the Ottoman Empire, which I'll discuss in a little bit. There were other complicating countries like Italy, Bulgaria, and Japan, but I don't want to go too far down this rabbit hole because it's not necessary for today's episode. You often hear that the most unstable part of Europe for centuries has been the Balkans. A lot of people wonder, what the heck are the Balkans? I'm not sure why it's always spoken about in the plural, Balkans. It refers to the large area of Southeast Europe, which is the Balkan Peninsula. That includes everything between the Adriatic Sea on the west, the Black Sea on the east, and the Aegean Sea in the south. It's a huge area which comprises the current countries of Greece, Bulgaria, Romania, North Macedonia, Albania, Montenegro, Serbia, Slovenia, Croatia, and Bosnia and Herzegovina. By the way, that last one is one country, even though it has two proper nouns in its name, Bosnia and Herzegovina. It's often just called Bosnia, and for simplicity's sake, that is the name I will be using throughout this episode. The Balkans were considered the most volatile region in Europe. The primary reason for this is that the ethnic groups are completely interspersed. In France, the vast majority of people are ethnically French. The same in Germany, where most people are ethnically German. But in the Balkans, many different ethnic groups are mixed together. You cannot draw nice, neat borders around a particular area and say that that area only contained a particular nationality. Even today, with all of the small separate countries in the Balkans, each country contains several minorities. As an example, not everybody in Serbia identifies as a Serb. The country of Serbia contains people who identify as, in addition to Serbs, Hungarian, Roma, Bosniak, Slovak, Croat, and other nationalities. People in the Balkans thought of themselves as a particular nationality based upon language and religion. The fact that these nationalities were so interspersed made for a very unstable region. Otto von Bismarck, the brilliant chancellor who unified Germany in 1871, predicted that the Balkans would be the cause of an enormous European conflict. In 1888, he famously predicted, "One day the great European war will come out of some damned foolish thing in the Balkans." At one point, all of the Balkan Peninsula was part of the Ottoman Empire. Today, most people don't remember the Ottoman Empire, but it lasted for centuries and dominated the Middle East, North Africa, and the Balkans in Europe. World War I ended the Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman Empire was broken up into several new states. Today, the remnant of the Ottoman Empire is the current country of Turkey. But there was a period where the Ottomans were expanding further into Europe from the Balkans. They were turned back in 1683 at the Battle of Vienna. There are legends that the croissant is shaped the way it is because of the Battle of Vienna. The city of Vienna was under siege by the Ottomans for a couple of months. When the siege was finally broken, the Ottomans turned away and Vienna was saved. According to the legend, the bakers created a special pastry to celebrate the Battle of Vienna and shaped it like the crescent moon because the crescent moon was the symbol on the Ottoman flag. I personally love croissants and wish that the story was true, but it's not. The croissant is a French invention which was based upon a Viennese pastry called a kipfel, which is generally shaped like a crescent moon. Aha, so it did come from Vienna. Yes, but the kipfel was around long before the Battle of Vienna. A poem from the 1200s mentions that the kipfel was a Christmas treat. Since this was 400 years before the Battle of Vienna, it appears that the origin of the croissant, based upon the crescent moon of the Ottoman flag, is just a cute story, but not true. Getting back to today's episode, the situation in the spring of 1914 was that the Ottoman Empire had been driven out of most of the Balkans. By 1914, there were new independent countries in the Balkans that had previously been part of the Ottoman Empire. The country that's significant for today's episode is Serbia. Serbia became an independent country in 1817. The people of Serbia are ethnically Slavs. Who are the Slavs? The Slavs are the largest European ethno-linguistic group. They speak various Slavic languages. They are basically broken down into three subgroups of the Eastern Slavs, primarily Russians, the Western Slavs, which include Poles, Czechs, and Slovaks, and the Southern Slavs, which include the Bosniaks, Bulgarians, Croats, Macedonians, Montenegrins, Serbs, and Slovenes. These ethnicities are all subsets of the Slavic peoples. The Slavs in the Balkans were all considered Southern Slavs. This explains some of the motives as to why some Serbs would be willing to help people like Gavrilo Princip as a fellow Slav trying to break away from the Austro-Hungarian Empire. A large population of Slavs were in the province of Bosnia, which was in the Austro-Hungarian Empire. The Austro-Hungarian province of Bosnia bordered the independent country of Serbia. There were many people in Serbia and throughout the Balkans that longed for a country unifying the South Slavic peoples. Spoiler, that eventually occurred after World War I, and the country was eventually called Yugoslavia. Unfortunately, Yugoslavia did not last and broke up in the 1990s. Okay, you have enough background. This brings us to the main character of this episode, Gavrilo Princip. Princip was a Bosnian. He was born on July 25, 1894, in the village of Oblijaj in Bosnia. I have no idea if I'm pronouncing that village correctly. His family were poor farmers. When he was a teenager, Gavrilo went to school in the Bosnian capital of Sarajevo. Any baby boomers listening to this episode might recognize that name, Sarajevo. In 1984, it was part of Yugoslavia and was the host city of the Winter Olympics. Unfortunately, less than a decade after the Olympics, Sarajevo became a battlefield as it was ground zero in the Bosnian War as part of the disintegration of Yugoslavia. For centuries, Bosnia was part of the Ottoman Empire. In 1878, Bosnia came under the administration of Austria-Hungary. Bosnia was no longer controlled by the Ottoman Empire. Then, in 1908, Austria-Hungary annexed Bosnia. Bosnia was now officially part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. This was not with the consent of the Bosnians. Most of the locals did not want to become part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. A dream of most of the Slavic peoples in the Balkans was for a country that unified the southern Slavs. As I explained earlier, that came to fruition after World War I with the formation of Yugoslavia. But before World War I, a united country of the southern Slavs was simply a dream of young Slavs from Bosnia, Serbia, and other parts of the Balkans. Gavrilo Princip joined other young radicals who wanted Bosnia freed from Austria-Hungary. This separatist and revolutionary movement was known as Young Bosnia. As a result of his participation in demonstrations with Young Bosnia, Princip was expelled from school. He left Sarajevo and walked all the way to Belgrade, the capital of the independent country of Serbia. It's roughly 170 miles between Sarajevo and Belgrade. That is one long walk. You've heard me mention Archduke Ferdinand several times. But who was that guy? The autocrat in charge of the Austro-Hungarian Empire was Franz Joseph. His title was Emperor of Austria and King of Hungary. It was weird that he had two titles, but he was the one person in charge of the entire Austro-Hungarian Empire. And although he had two titles, people usually just refer to him as the emperor. In 1914, Emperor Franz Joseph, was 84 years old. The heir apparent to the throne was the emperor's nephew, Archduke Franz Ferdinand, who was 50 years old. Since he was next in line, and the fact that his uncle was 84 years old, people assumed that Franz Ferdinand would be taking over as emperor relatively soon. Now let's get to what happened in Sarajevo. The government of Austria-Hungary announced that Franz Ferdinand and his wife, Sophie, would be visiting Sarajevo. That was the capital of the Austro-Hungarian province of Bosnia. Remember that most of the people of Bosnia did not want to be part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. This meant that the royal family of Austria-Hungary was not very popular in Bosnia, but the Archduke thought it was a good idea to visit the different parts of the empire. Turns out, this was actually a very bad idea. In the spring of 1914, Gavrilo Princip read in the newspaper that Archduke Ferdinand would be visiting Sarajevo in June of that year. Princip immediately planned on murdering the Archduke when he visited Sarajevo. Princip joined with six other young men in a conspiracy to assassinate Franz Ferdinand. The would-be assassins needed weapons, so they sought help from the Black Hand. That was a secret nationalist group based in Serbia that wanted to assist their fellow Slavs in breaking away from Austria-Hungary. The Black Hand provided Princip and his co-conspirators with four handguns and six hand grenades, or handheld bombs, along with bullets, money, and suicide pills. Princip and the others practiced their aim by shooting in a city park in Belgrade. This might be my favorite part of the story. The fact that they were practicing their marksmanship by shooting in a city park. Apparently this was okay because there's no record of them being arrested for shooting in a city park. On June 28, 1914, Franz Ferdinand, his wife, and the rest of their party were going to tour Sarajevo in open automobiles. Yes, this meant that they would be in convertibles with the tops down so that people could see them. This also meant that they presented easy targets. The citizens of Sarajevo had been advised that the Archduke's motorcade would travel along a road called Apple Key to a reception at Town Hall. Apple Key Road went right along the Miljaka River. That river passes through the heart of Sarajevo, and there are many bridges across the river in that city. The assassins set up along Apple Key. As the motorcade drove along Apple Key, they passed by the first two would-be assassins who both failed to act. Apparently they froze because they did not make any attempt to assassinate Franz Ferdinand. The third conspirator on the road was a man named Nedeljko Kabrinovic. Please forgive me for my pronunciation of this guy's name. Kabrinovic threw a bomb at the Archduke's car. The bomb bounced off the car and landed in the street. It exploded under the next car in the motorcade. Nobody was killed, but several were injured. Kabrinovic did not wish to be taken alive, so he swallowed his cyanide capsule and jumped into the river. Unfortunately for him, the poison pill did not kill him. It only induced vomiting. And Kabrinovic did not realize that the river was very shallow during the summer months. It was less than a foot deep. The police easily captured Kabrinovic. He was beaten and then taken into custody. After this near miss, the motorcade sped up and proceeded to Town Hall as scheduled for a reception. The people at the Town Hall acted like there had not been an assassination attempt. Purportedly, the mayor proceeded with his scheduled speech, but was interrupted by Archduke Ferdinand, who said, "Mr. Mayor, I came here on a visit and I am greeted with bombs. It is outrageous." After the reception at the Town Hall, the Archduke and his party were supposed to go to a museum and then return to Vienna that evening. Franz Ferdinand canceled the trip to the museum. He said he wanted to go to the hospital to visit the people who were injured from the bomb explosion earlier in the day. This meant that the motorcade was going to take a different route since they would be going to the hospital instead of the museum. However, the driver of the Archduke's car was apparently unaware of this change in plans. After leaving the town hall, the motorcade started driving along the Apple Quay, essentially going back over the same route they had traveled earlier, but now going in the opposite direction. When they reached the road, which at that time was called the Franz Josef Gasse, the Archduke's driver turned right. This was the route that would take them to the museum as originally scheduled. Apparently, the Archduke's driver did not know of the change in plans, and he should have continued straight along the Apple Quay. When the driver turned right onto Franz Josef Gasse, he was told that he was going the wrong way. So he stopped the car to either back up or turn around. Serendipity intervened because Gavrilo Princip was standing right there. Princip did not know of the change in plans to go to the hospital. Princip had expected the Archduke to go to the museum after the reception at Town Hall, so he was standing on that corner when the Archduke's driver made the right turn. Princip figured that the car would slow down to turn onto Franz Josef Gasse. If the driver had continued along the Apple Quay, Princip might not have gotten a good shot at a moving car. But when the driver stopped on Franz Josef Gasse to back up or turn around onto Apple Quay, the Archduke was a perfect target. Princip could not believe his luck that the car stopped right in front of him. He shot twice into the car. One shot hit Sophie and one shot hit her husband. Sophie was shot in the side and the Archduke was shot in the jugular vein. They both died shortly thereafter. Before he could get off a third shot, Princip was subdued by one of the Imperial Guards or a policeman. It's now time to dispel the most persistent myth about this assassination. In books and documentaries or online, you will see the myth that Gavrilo Princip thought he had missed his opportunity after the bomb thrown by Nedeljko Kobrinovic missed the Archduke. The motorcade sped up, and Gavrilo Princip did not get a chance to shoot Franz Ferdinand. According to the myth, Princip was dejected because he did not get a chance to assassinate the heir apparent. So he went to have a sandwich at a local cafe called Schiller's Delicatessen. According to this myth, Princip was sitting there eating his sandwich, thinking he had failed, when he looked up and saw the car containing Franz Ferdinand stopped right in front of Schiller's Delicatessen. So he ran out of the restaurant and shot the Archduke. Unfortunately, this is not true. There were no references to the sandwich story prior to 2003. Days That Shook the World is a British documentary TV series that premiered on the BBC in September 2003. One of the events covered in that BBC documentary is the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand. That documentary was broadcast in Britain and the United States and tells of the incredible coincidence that Gavrilo Princip was eating a sandwich at Schiller's Deli when the Archduke's car stopped right in front of him. Historians have tried to figure out how this myth started, and it appears that the sandwich story became popular because of that documentary, Days That Shook the World. But it seems that the true origin of the myth came from a 2001 Brazilian novel. Not a history text, but a novel. Yes, fiction. The novel was called 12 Fingers, Biography of an Anarchist. It was written by a Brazilian named Joe Soares. You can buy it on Amazon now. The novel has a scene with the assassination and had Gavrilo Princip going to the cafe to get a sandwich. Then the car with the Archduke stopped right in front of the cafe. The reason I go into this is because I hate when stories become supposed facts when they are simply not true. There are a lot of things in history that get told repeatedly and people start to believe that they are true. The sandwich story is irritating because it makes people believe that the reason why the assassination occurred was because Princip went to get a sandwich and the car carrying the Archduke happened to stop right in front of the deli. Princip was standing in the proper location if the Archduke had gone to the museum as originally planned. The lucky part was that the Archduke's driver made a mistake and turned right onto Franz Josef Gasse to take the route to go to the museum when he should have kept going straight on Apple Quay. It's that wrong right turn by the driver that was lucky for Gavrilo Princip and led to the assassination. By the way, Schiller's Delicatessen was a real place. It's now a museum dedicated to the assassination. Let's get back to June 28, 1914. Franz Ferdinand and his wife Sophie are dead. Gavrilo Princip and his co-conspirators are arrested. Contrary to popular belief, World War I does not immediately break out, but the war does start exactly 1 month later. There was plenty of time in that month to avert a major war that would cost millions of lives. But unfortunately, the people running the government of Austria-Hungary thought that this was a great chance to put Serbia in its place. Keep in mind that Serbia was an independent country and the assassination did not take place in Serbia. Sarajevo is located in the province of Bosnia, which at that time was within the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Gavrilo Princip and his fellow assassins were not citizens of Serbia. They were citizens of Austria-Hungary. But the powers that be in Vienna were convinced that Serbia was behind the assassination. It's a long and complicated story, which I cannot get into all of the details in this episode. But here are the pertinent facts. The government of Austria-Hungary starts threatening Serbia. The Russian leaders tell Serbia that they will defend them if Austria-Hungary invades Serbia. Austria-Hungary turns to their best friends and allies, the German Empire. And what was probably the most critical point where the war could have been averted, on July 5th, 1914, Kaiser Wilhelm tells the Austro-Hungarians that he will back them if they are attacked by Russia. The Kaiser did not put any conditions on his pledge to back Austria-Hungary. This is usually referred to as the blank check. This meant that the government of Austria-Hungary was free to create any circumstances which might result in war with Russia, and their powerful friends, the Germans, would come to their rescue. Much of the journey to war occurred because the four continental great powers, Russia, Germany, France, and Austria-Hungary, were afraid of getting caught unprepared. Britain had the English Channel to protect them from a surprise invasion. Because each of the four continental powers did not want to be invaded while they were vulnerable, they started mobilizing. What do I mean by that term, mobilization? It is when a country gets its military forces ready for imminent warfare. In World War I, mobilization meant, number one, although each of these countries had standing armies, they still needed to call up their reserve troops. Number two, they had to move their troops to the borders for either invasion of their neighbors or defense from their neighbors. And number three, logistics. A lot of people don't think much about logistics, but if you are going to send hundreds of thousands of soldiers into battle, you need to supply them with food, water, uniforms, rifles, artillery pieces, bullets for the rifles, shells for the artillery pieces, observation equipment like binoculars and hot air balloons, medical supplies, communications equipment, equipment to move artillery pieces, and transportation to move the millions of items necessary to supply an army in the field. It takes time to mobilize the troops and get the logistics in order. And although European countries in 1914 already had military plans in case a war broke out, detailed orders had to be drafted to give the multiple army units instructions on exactly where they needed to go and exactly what they needed to do. The reason I outline mobilization is so you can understand why the European leaders acted as they did. Each of those governments thought that they had to mobilize their military forces because if they didn't and the enemy did mobilize, they might easily be overrun. It was this thinking that made all of those countries mobilize so they were not caught, not ready to defend themselves. The chief instigator in all this was definitely Austria-Hungary. Once Kaiser Wilhelm assured the Austro-Hungarians that Germany would back them up in any war, the government of Austria-Hungary got very aggressive with Serbia. On July 23, 1914, a little over 3 weeks after the assassination in Sarajevo, Austria-Hungary gave an ultimatum to Serbia. Austria-Hungary wanted Serbia to decline the ultimatum so they would have an excuse to invade Serbia. That's one reason why they gave Serbia only 48 hours to reply. And the government of Austria-Hungary purposely made the ultimatum contain demands that they did not believe the Serbians could accept. To everybody's surprise, Serbia agreed to most of the terms in the ultimatum except one. That was the demand that officials from Austria-Hungary would be able to go into Serbia to investigate whether or not Serbia had anything to do with the assassination. Some people hoped that the close blood relationships of three of the leaders could avert the war. King George V of the United Kingdom, Kaiser Wilhelm II of Germany, and Tsar Nicholas II were all cousins. George and Wilhelm were first cousins. George and Nicholas were also first cousins. And Wilhelm and Nicholas were third cousins. When they corresponded with each other, they referred to each other as Georgie, Willie, and Nicky. If you look at photographs of King George V of Britain and Russian Tsar Nicholas II, they really look alike. You would think that they were brothers. But the close family ties did nothing to avert the war. When Serbia refused to give into every demand of the Austro-Hungarian ultimatum, the Austro-Hungarian government got the excuse it wanted and declared war on Serbia on July 28. That was exactly 1 month after the assassination in Sarajevo. Since Russia would defend their fellow Slavs in Serbia, this meant war between Russia and Austria-Hungary. Then, because of alliances, Germany and France automatically entered the war. The UK wasn't sure about joining the war, but when Germany invaded neutral Belgium, Britain entered the war. Within a couple of weeks after Austria-Hungary declared war on Serbia, the five major powers of Europe had all declared war. The two sides are listed as the Central Powers, which were Germany and Austria-Hungary, and the Allies, which were France, Britain, and Russia. The three Allied powers were at war with the two Central Powers. The Central Powers were joined in the autumn of 1914 by the Ottoman Empire. Eventually, other countries would join World War I, including the United States, in April 1917. Plainly, I cannot get into detail as to what happened in World War I. I can only give you the briefest summary. Within weeks, the war bogged down into trench warfare with very little movement. At least that was the case on the Western Front. The Eastern Front was more fluid, but I just don't have time to go into that. Machine guns, barbed wire, and heavy artillery made it practically impossible for attacking armies. All of the advantages were on the defensive side. This resulted in stagnant warfare, with the generals on both sides not knowing how to win. So mostly, they simply sent thousands upon thousands of men over the top. That was the term that meant climbing out of their trenches and advancing across no man's land, filled with barbed wire and being mowed down by machine guns and heavy artillery from the defenders. To break the stalemate, both sides eventually used chemical weapons, most notably mustard gas. Again, I'm just describing the Western Front to keep this podcast relatively simple and short. The killing finally stopped with the armistice at the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month of 1918. Until 1954, November 11 was known as Armistice Day in the United States. Since 1954, it's now known as Veterans Day in the U.S. I've always liked this passage from one of my favorite writers, Kurt Vonnegut, in his book, Breakfast of Champions, where he wrote, "So this book is a sidewalk strewn with junk, trash which I throw over my shoulders as I travel in time back to November 11th, 1922. I will come to a time in my backwards trip when November 11th Accidentally, my birthday was a sacred day called Armistice Day. When I was a boy, and when Dwayne Hoover was a boy, all of the people of all of the nations which had fought in the First World War were silent during the 11th minute of the 11th hour of Armistice Day, which was the 11th day of the 11th month. It was during that minute in 1918 that millions upon millions of human beings stopped butchering one another. I have talked to old men who were on battlefields during that minute. They have told me in one way or another that the sudden silence was the voice of God. So we still have among us some men who can remember when God spoke clearly to mankind. Armistice Day has become Veterans Day. Armistice Day was sacred. Veterans Day is not. So I will throw Veterans Day over my shoulder. Armistice Day I will keep. I don't want to throw away any sacred things. What else is sacred? Oh, Romeo and Juliet, for instance. And all music is. That's the end of that passage from Breakfast of Champions. I love Kurt Vonnegut. By the end of World War I, four empires were gone. The Ottoman Empire, which had lasted for centuries, was broken up into many new countries. Turkey essentially became the successor state of the Ottoman Empire. Some of the Ottoman territories became colonies of France and Britain, but they didn't want to use that term colonies. So these areas were called mandates, but they essentially amounted to colonies. Eventually, the old Ottoman Empire would become the modern Middle East. Since no thought was really given to what was best for the local peoples when these countries were created, a lot of the problems in the Middle East today were created from the remnants of the Ottoman Empire. The Russian Revolution occurred in 1917, a year before World War I ended. The Russian Empire was dead. It was replaced with the USSR, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, which would become one of the most repressive and murderous regimes in history. The German Empire was also finished. Germany lived on as a republic, but Germany lost all of its overseas colonies and some of its territory in Europe. By the time of the Great Depression at the start of the 1930s, large segments of the population no longer wanted a democracy and turned to the Nazis. The Austro-Hungarian Empire was broken up. New countries were formed from the remnants of Austria-Hungary, and some new countries came from territories that had belonged to the German Empire or the Russian Empire. After World War I, Europe had the following countries which had not existed when Gavrilo Princip shot Franz Ferdinand in June 1914. Finland, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Czechoslovakia, Yugoslavia, Poland, Austria, and Hungary. Those last two were now the small independent countries of Austria and Hungary. They were no longer part of the same Austro-Hungarian Empire. Poland was not exactly a brand new country. Poland had been a country up until 1795 when its three aggressive neighbors of Russia, Austria, and Prussia, which essentially would later unite with other states to become Germany, agreed to partition Poland among the three of them. Think about that. The Russians, Austrians, and Prussians did not want to fight each other over Poland, so they simply agreed to divide Poland between the three of them. As a result, Poland did not exist for 123 years, but was recreated after World War I. And you might have noticed that I mentioned Yugoslavia as a new country after World War I. Yes, the dreams of Gavrilo Princip and other countless Slavs in the Balkans was realized. Right after World War I, the country was known as the Kingdom of Serbs, Croats, and Slovenes. In 1929, the Kingdom of Serbs, Croats, and Slovenes adopted the new name of Yugoslavia. The name Yugoslavia means the land of the South Slavs. Starting in the early 1990s, Yugoslavia broke apart. There are now seven independent countries which were once Yugoslavia: Slovenia, Croatia, Montenegro, North Macedonia, Serbia, Kosovo, and the country of Bosnia and Herzegovina. And yes, I included Kosovo. Serbia still claims Kosovo is part of Serbia. However, the United States government recognizes Kosovo as an independent country. What happened to Gavrilo Princip and the others involved in the assassination plot? They were tried and convicted in October 1914. Under the laws of Austria-Hungary, nobody under 20 years of age at the time of their crime could receive the death penalty. Since Princip was 19 years old when he committed the assassination, he was given the maximum sentence of 20 years. Nedeljko Kobrinovic, the guy who threw the bomb at the Archduke's car, was also 19 years old on the day of the assassination. So, like Gavrilo Princip, he was given a prison sentence of 20 years. Kobrinovic died in prison on January 23, 1916. We think he died of tuberculosis. Gavrilo Princip did not live to see the formation of Yugoslavia. He didn't even live to see the end of World War I. After he was convicted for the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand, Princip spent the rest of his life in the same prison as his co-conspirator, Nedeljko Kobrinovic. That was the prison known as the Small Fortress outside the town of Terezin. That town is now part of the Czech Republic, but during World War I, it was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Princip was kept in solitary confinement. At night, he was chained to the wall. Princip died of tuberculosis on April 28, 1918, exactly 3 years and 10 months after he assassinated the Archduke in Sarajevo. He was only 23 years old. At the time of his death, he supposedly weighed around 90 pounds due to malnutrition and the ravages of tuberculosis. He was buried in an unmarked grave near the prison. But after the war, in 1920, Princip was exhumed and transferred to Sarajevo and buried in the Vidovdin Heroes Chapel. Gavrilo Princip is a divisive figure. Some people see him as a terrorist. Some people see him as a freedom fighter. I think it's unfair when people compare him to modern-day terrorists who commit mass murder. This was a targeted attack against a specific person. It's true that the Archduke's wife, Sophie, was also killed. I'm not saying political murder is okay. I'm just pointing out that what Gavrilo Princip did is different than somebody who blows up an entire building with many innocent casualties. There are people in Bosnia, as well as Serbia, that revere the assassin. In 2014, 100 years after the assassination, a statue of Gavrilo Princip was unveiled in Sarajevo. 1 year later, a statue of Princip was dedicated in Belgrade, the capital of Serbia. When the statue was dedicated in Belgrade, Serbian President Tomislav Nikolic made it clear how he viewed Princip when he told the crowd, "Today we are not afraid of the truth. Gavrilo Princip was a hero, a symbol of the idea of freedom, the assassin of tyrants, and the carrier of the European idea of liberation from slavery." That's it for today. Please subscribe to this podcast. Please like this and my other episodes. Ratings and likes greatly help with the placement of podcasts on apps. If you're listening on a podcast app like Spotify or Apple Podcasts, which allow for ratings, I would greatly appreciate a 5-star rating. Some apps allow for reviews, and I'd also appreciate a kind review. Please tell your friends, relatives, coworkers. Word of mouth is the best way to increase the audience for this podcast. Check out my website, historyanalyze.com, where you will find fine items for all the history geeks out there. Thank you for listening. Catch you next episode.